Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how could a Kamala Harris-led ticket play in Arizona, where Republicans have a registration advantage? And a new book documents the life and career of one of the Valley's most renowned architects. But first, tomorrow is primary day in Arizona. And voters from both parties will be heading to the polls to choose their nominees for a variety of races, from who will be running to be our next U.S. senator to who will square off for Congress, all the way down to who will become the candidates for mayor in some Valley cities. But a lot of voters will not be heading to the polls tomorrow, because they've already voted. In fact, hundreds of thousands of Democratic and Republican voters in Arizona have already returned their primary ballots. And our next guest is here to tell us everything we know about those early ballot returns. Sam Almy is a data analyst for Uplift Campaigns, a Democratic political strategist who also tracks early ballots. Good morning there, Sam. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Lauren. I appreciate it.
Okay, so tell us the big picture stuff first. Like, what does turnout look like so far? How many ballots have been cast?
So right now, this is as of Thursday morning. I'm still waiting on Friday's data for Maricopa County. We have 841,000 total returns statewide. That puts turnout at around 20.5%.
Okay. What do you estimate turnout could look like in the end after voters go to the poll tomorrow? Do we have a good sense of that at this point?
I have a pretty good sense of it. This election is actually turning out, as far as turnout wise, very similar to 2020 and 2022. So I'm estimating turnout in the low 30%. That's what we saw the last couple cycles. So we're probably going to get around 1.2, 1.3 million ballots in the next 2 days.
It sounds like a lot, but still, you know, in the 30% there. Let's talk about what we know about those early ballots that have already been returned. Give us the general breakdown. What parties are they from? What parts of the state? What do we know?
Well, they're coming from all over. Obviously, Maricopa and Pima make up over 80% of the ballots. That's pretty typical. That's where all the registered voters are. On the Democratic side, we have 372,000 ballots turned in. About 31,000 of those are from independent voters, or 8%. And on the GOP side, we have 460,000 ballots turned in, and 40,000 are from independents, which again is about 8.5% of all ballots.
And Democratic turnout, it sounds like, is a tad lower than it has been in the last couple elections. Is that still true?
It is. It is down about 1%. From 2022. That's actually something that I've been looking at because, you know, there was a thought that there would be a little bit of enthusiasm gap for the Democrats. Mm-hmm. Down 1% in a primary, that's something to look at, but not be overly concerned for a general election.
Were you surprised it wasn't lower?
Yeah, a little bit, yes. I'm generally pessimistic. So having this right on track with 2020 and 2022 is really encouraging for Democrats.
So then does it matter, Sam, you think, that Democrats just changed the top of the ticket after many voters had already cast those primary ballots? Like, those, you know, presidential candidates obviously aren't on this ballot, but does it change that enthusiasm gap, that calculation?
I don't know if we're going to see that for this primary election specifically, but it certainly does change the enthusiasm on the Democratic side. You know, I have a lot of anecdata right now. Social media is enjoyable to be on. There's lots of memes and such around Vice President Harris. That's always nice to see. Things like the assassination on Trump has taken a backseat to this news, In addition to that, all the messaging that the GOP had at their convention against Joe Biden is now lost.
The swings of the races. You also track things like voter age in early ballots. What are we seeing so far?
Unsurprisingly, this is very similar for most early voting, primary or general election. The voters are older. I think right now we're looking at 60% of all voters, of all ballots cast, are 65 plus. This is pretty typical to see. It's going to get a little bit younger in the next few days. Generally, the 45 and under crowd vote. They either drop off their ballots at the polls or simply vote in person.
Yeah. Does that change significantly when it comes to the general election as well? Like what is the kind of typical profile of a primary voter?
You're going to see something very similar, especially with early vote. Because these people are the informed electorate. They voted before. We like to call them 4x4s, meaning they've voted in four of the last four elections. They usually turn out early. They know who they're voting for. They just want to cast their ballot and be done with it. It's the undecided, the lower turnout voters that tend to be a little bit younger. They will come out in week three and week four of voting.
Yeah. Last minute or so here, I want to drill down on a few of the legislative districts that are being closely watched this primary cycle. Like, are you seeing anything surprising in some of those districts where there will be some tight primary races?
Nothing particular for legislative districts. I know I have my eye on the LD-17 race down in Tucson with Senator Wadsack and Vince Leach on, on the Republican side. That turnout is about even with 2022, maybe even a little bit higher. So that's interesting to see those new voters coming into that race.
Last question for you. What does all of this say so far, you think, about where we will be on general election day? Like, are there trends you're watching for, things that are sort of canaries in the coal mine in terms of turnout or party advantage heading into November?
That's a great question. One of the things that I'm seeing right now is that Republicans have returned to having a ballot advantage during the early voting period in 2020 and 2022. We saw that the Dems were leading in returns despite being third in registration. Prior to 2020, Republicans had led virtually throughout all of early voting. We're seeing a return to that in the primary here, and I'm curious as to see if that trend holds for the general election as well.
Very interesting stuff. All right. Sam Almy, a data analyst for Uplift Campaigns, joining us with that early ballot breakdown. Sam, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren.
The entire political world has pretty much turned upside down in the last week. Yes, it's only been about a week and a day since President Biden stepped aside and opened the door for Vice President Kamala Harris to take the helm of the Democratic Party and likely the presidential nomination. And on top of that, she just might pick Arizona Senator Mark Kelly as her VP. So how will all of this play in Arizona? We're one of a very few important swing states in this year's presidential race, a border state chock full of independent voters with a capital I. Joe Biden won here in 2020, but just with 10,000 votes. For more on all of that, we turn to our regular Monday opinion voice, the Arizona Republic's editorial page editor, Alvia Diaz, as well as columnist Phil Boas. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. So the reason I wanted to talk to both of you today is because you come at this from different points of view, different sides of the aisle. So let's talk about what you're both thinking as we kind of watch history be written in front of us, as I think you put it in a recent column, Phil. And I want to start with you, Alvia. Kamala Harris has raised a record amount of money in the last week. Democrats have quickly coalesced around her as the likely candidate. Do you think this momentum is real? Do you think it will continue?
Well, I absolutely think it's real, and not just because of what I see on TV, but what I hear from people at my level, and at my level meaning ordinary people, just going to the grocery stores, just being so excited about the new campaign. So yes, it's absolutely real, and the money that she has raised indicates that as well, you know, that is coming from big donors and small donors that wanted someone else and got someone else. You know, they just didn't know that they had that someone else right in the White House. Now, will it continue? That's the big question. So the campaign will tell you yes, but it's anyone's guess, right? We don't know. I mean, things have changed so much, as you said that in the intro, within just 2 weeks, that we'll see.
Okay, so Phil, you come at this from an interesting point of view as well. You are a lifelong Republican, but you've never been like a Trump guy. You wrote that both parties, you think, are in jeopardy now. Why?
So this has clearly changed the dimensions of the race, and we're going to see very soon, as things settle down, as the initial euphoria begins to rub off a little bit and you begin to see just how this race will play over the next several months. And for both parties, there's a lot of danger. You know, it's going to be a close race, it looks like. That's generally the case in a presidential election. They tend to tighten up right near the end, and everybody's on pins and needles. So we can expect that again with what the move that the Democrats have made.
Yeah, yeah. You also wrote a column about Harris and her record and some potential pitfalls there, and sort of the way the media is talking about this, maybe in this initial euphoria. What's your view? Do you think that she's getting treated with kid gloves?
Well, I think she's going to be introduced to the country more so than she has been. People really don't have much of an understanding of her background and the positions she's taken in the past. She's a progressive liberal, and that record is going to be coming out, and there will be a lot of attacks on her. Now, it's going to be different than the attacks that the Democrats are now making with Donald Trump, because you know, Trump has been attacked now for 10 years, and it's almost like throwing a glass of water at the ocean. You know, it doesn't have much impact the way it once did. With Kamala Harris, a lot of these attacks are new, and people are hearing facts for the first time. They're hearing the opposition coming back at her for the first time.
Well, I mean, when we talk about her record, it is a White House record. The president is the one in charge. I think her biggest challenge is the border, and not necessarily because she personally was not able to do anything about it, but who knows what happened behind the scenes. If she was able, or if she was allowed to actually do it, I have a sense now that it was the White House who kept her really at bay. Yeah, she was given the charge of the border, and I think that's going to be an issue. Although she, at the beginning, you know, that was one of my criticism as well, that she wanted to tackle, the White House wanted to tackle the border issue from the root causes, which is where immigration is coming from. And, you know, she was immediately attacked about not visiting the border. But in reality, in the long term, that's how we're going to fix the border, right? But, you know, that is going to be her biggest challenge, I believe. But then it all depends who she's going to pick for vice president and how she's going to counter that. So far, we have seen that she has what it takes to take on Donald Trump and actually take on the border, because keep in mind that her biggest challenge is also the Republicans' challenge, because we have a presidential candidate, a former president, who specifically told the Democrats not to fix the border because he wanted to make this a campaign issue. So who's really who has the biggest weakness here when it comes to immigration?
Let me ask you both about Mark Kelly and a potential vice president for a Harris ticket. We talked with you about this last week on the show, Elvia, and you think this is a great idea. Phil, you wrote that Kelly should have Republicans worried here in a way that maybe Kamala Harris shouldn't. Why do you say that?
Yeah, so I think the reason that Republicans should be concerned if Harris chooses Mark Kelly is that Mark Kelly checks a lot of the boxes that are sort of traditional values in America. You know, he's a political neophyte. He's new to politics, but he's had a long career. And he is not, you know, the most eloquent of the people on the short list. You know, people like Josh Shapiro, who's the governor of Pennsylvania, Tim Walz, governor of Minnesota. But deeds themselves have eloquence. And he has accomplished a lot in his life. I mean, he has flown 39 combat missions, 4 space missions. He's had 375 carrier landings. He's won the Defense Superior Service Medal. He's won the Legion of Merit, 2 Distinguished Flying Crosses. And the man has done a lot in his lifetime. And that's going to speak to Americans. And it's the kind of thing that Americans of all stripes really admire.
I wonder, how much do you think that makes a difference in Arizona? I mean, like, it's one of several swing states with some electoral votes, but not as many as maybe Pennsylvania or a state like that. I mean, do you think the VP ends up making a huge difference in any case?
I don't think it's going to make a difference in Arizona. I think Arizona is probably going to go Republican this year. And I think that's because the registration advantage for the Republicans has opened up even more over the last decade. So it's a strange thing, as a lot of the statewide offices go to Democrats, but the Republicans have a pretty strong advantage now in voter registration. So, and it just looks like they're going to move in that direction. The polling has all been in that direction.
I disagree. I mean, voter registration advantages there, Phil is absolutely correct. But I mean, Mark Hill is one of those guys and senators that is well-liked here in the state. I mean, you mentioned there at the intro that President Biden won by only 10,000 votes. So I do believe that he could deliver Arizona for the president. You know, it's going to come down to who is able to incentivize more people to come out to vote, right? So you have Republicans with a huge advantage over Democrats, but then you have independents, which are the third of the registered voters. So who's going to do that? And who's going to incentivize women? Who's going to incentivize Latinos, African-Americans to come out in force? And I think Mark Kelly can do that. And I think that's partly why he is being seriously considered as a running mate.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. Much more to talk about as this continues, though, of course, that is the Arizona Republic's editorial page editor, Elvia Diaz, as well as columnist Phil Boas, joining us to talk all of this through. Thank you both for coming on. Appreciate it, as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a sustainable architect reflects on his career of more than 50 years after making Arizona home. But first, the Arizona Medical Association has a new leader, and he comes from a part of the state that he says has a lot of healthcare needs. Dr. Nadeem Kazi is a gastroenterologist who's been practicing in Casa Grande for the last 27 years. He says he came to the Pinal County City in 1997 for 1 year, which then became more than two decades. He spoke earlier with my co-host, Mark Brody.
The need for physician in that area, not only physician, patients also have a different setup. The requirement is different, and the state has to hear about the rural area's requirement, and that's how I start working with Arizona Medical Association for 20 years in different capacity, different positions, and leading to the presidency of Arizona Medical Association.
So in your mind, then, what are the biggest needs of rural communities when it comes to medicine and healthcare in Arizona?
The major issue that we are feeling right now is the lack of physicians, lack of nursing staff, lack of paramedical staff. That's a huge issue that we are facing. And it's not only in Arizona, throughout the country. And some people come with suggestion, medical student, give them license and start practicing medicine. The answer to is not improper care. There is no difference between improper care and the no care, because improper care lead to more problems. So what we are suggesting, and this year I'm working on, and governor also believe in this thing, that we have to increase graduate medical education. So that is very important to increase the supply of physicians, and also same thing with nurses. And until we have manpower, it's going to be very difficult to take care of healthcare of this state. This is one of the problems. Second issue is the psychiatry. I mean, we don't have a good psychiatry services available in Arizona. And this is also a phenomenon throughout the country. And we are working on it to see how we can huge gap. Because if your mental health is not good, it's very difficult to take care of the physical health. So they go hand in hand. So this is another area that we are looking into, how to attract people into those fields. The main issue is the payment for the physicians. I mean, in last 20 years, 27 years since I've been practicing, there are so many cuts. I have never seen any time increasing in my fees, but the costs increasing. So majority of the private practice groups which used to run their offices, they are leaving and they are joining big corporations. And the corporations, they don't see the whole aspect of medicine. They just see how to save money here and how to provide care to more people with little, availability. So that's not going to work. It's going to fail in the next 5-6 years. That's another issue that we are facing. So we have to make private practices viable. And how to do it? Obviously, you have to attract people. We have to give money to them so they can sustain their practices. I'm at the verge. I'm a solo practitioner. I'm at the verge to walk out now because since COVID, everything is double. Whatever we buy, it's double. The salaries are almost 30% up. And my income is, you know, the reimbursement from insurance and Medicaid has went down. So I cannot sustain after the next 2-3 months. I have to make a hard decision to join hospital or to some corporation because I cannot sustain.
So the challenges that you mentioned are challenges that I think much of Arizona is facing. I wonder if it's maybe more acute in rural areas, or maybe it's just a little bit different in a place like Casa Grande than it might be in a place like Phoenix or Tucson.
Much acute in a rural area, not only Casa Grande or rural areas. There is no specialist, there is no physicians. They are seen by second level providers, and they need specialists to see. There is no specialist, and they have to wait months to get to the specialist by the time things have changed too much. So yes, it is very acute in rural area. We need to address that issue as soon as possible. And obviously, we have to give incentives to these physicians to get to those areas. Not only physicians, also nurses.
Right. I mean, other providers, right? That's what it sounds like you're saying. Well, I wonder then if there maybe need to be structural changes in how physicians are trained and maybe recruited to the state. You mentioned more graduate medical education, more residency programs, fellowships, things like that. If this is a problem that the entire state is dealing with, but it's much worse in rural areas, what needs to change to make sure that as maybe more graduate medical education programs come online, that those physicians don't all just stay in the Valley or in Tucson?
As I just mentioned, incentives, like they have to get extra pay for sacrificing city life. They have to, because there's no ifs and buts about it. If you pay them well, they will stay longer. And also give them incentive that they will get, each medical student who comes out right now is anywhere from $400,000 to $500,000 loan on them. Give incentive there to take half of the loan or full loan if you serve this area for 10 years or 5 years, whatever number they pick up. And those kind of incentive is needed. I mean, without incentive, you cannot expect people to just go there and stay there. So we have to look into those incentives, how to bring people in.
Do you get the sense that state leaders, political leaders, and policymakers understand this challenge and are willing and able to do some of these things?
My blunt answer is no. I don't think they don't care, but they don't, because there are so many other issues. They have to fix the budget. I mean, this year we have a huge budget deficit, so they are fighting on those issues. So they don't look at the bigger picture. So we have to, it has to be mindset change of our leaders, House and Senate, and also the governor has to work with them and see how to address this issue in long-term fashion, not just acute. So we have to change this mindset. So, and we are working on it. Arizona Medical is very active in educating the politicians about these issues and how to handle it. And we have committees and we have physicians who's trying to educate them. That's our responsibility and I think fiduciary duty also.
Do you think the fact that you are from one of these rural communities will help in that effort, that, you know, you can sort of bring this firsthand personal experience and knowledge to lawmakers and the governor?
That's what my whole year is going to be, working on this rural area issues. And that's what we are heading towards. Yeah. Obviously, I have experience for the last 27 years, all my colleagues, what they experience over there, what they feel. I can express these things to the leaders in the House and Senate.
All right. That is Dr. Nadeem Kazi, a gastroenterologist in Casa Grande, and the new president of the Arizona Medical Association. Dr. Kazi, thanks so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your time. Thanks a lot.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Why is Alexa a woman's voice? Why is Siri From AI to Barbies, our next guest explores the array of simulated females in today's worlds and just how realistic they've become. Julie Wask's research focuses on gender and technology, and in her most recent book, Artificial Women, Sex Dolls, Robot Caregivers, and More Facsimile Females, she explores what these imitations say about our own ideas of sexuality and gender. I spoke with her more about it.
Several years ago, I was in a flea market and I saw this mannequin head of a woman peering out at me. And I thought, wow, she looks real. And she was out of a paper bag. And I took a photograph of it and called it Bag Woman. And it occurred to me that that's the kind of moment we were already getting into, where simulated females look real. And that's, it could be wonderful or it could be troubling.
That's interesting. I want to begin with the scope of this, too. Like, I don't think most of us probably even realize all of the ways in which there are what you're calling artificial women around, whether it's in technology, robotics, you know, voice technology, AI. What's the scope of this?
It's a very broad scope. It includes stationary mannequins, but it's also anytime you see an avatar online or video game or movies like Barbie, and these avatars that people can create themselves using artificial intelligence. So I feel like it's in many ways all around us. And of course, I should mention Siri and Alexa. They're so important in our lives with their female voices.
So let me ask you about Siri and Alexa. This is probably the most ubiquitous example that you write about here, right? Like, let me begin with a very basic question here, which is, why are these voices women's voices?
Well, they started off that way because researchers felt, and Amazon felt, that a female voice is more pleasing. Also, people are used to women being helpful and polite, and they feel they're trustworthy as a voice they can listen to. Now, not too many years ago was the male voice added. And also, I will say there are warning voices in cockpits. So pilots listen to a female voice often as a warning signal.
Right. So, I wanted to ask you about this. This is referred to as something Betty, a word I probably can't say on air. Tell us about that.
Yes. Yeah, they have a name. It's a version of Nagging Betty. Although it's interesting, the research is not yet out whether male or female voices are more effective for very serious warning. If a hydraulic system is not working, for example. And they used to think a female voice could cut through cockpit chatter easier. Now they're still debating that.
So the idea that our virtual assistants, right, or the many of these kind of virtual voices we have around us that are there to help us or to warn us, right, like the idea that those are women's voices, what does that say about how we still view women today? Like, is this a step backward in some ways that might seem inane but maybe isn't?
Yeah, you could say that, because women traditionally have been in helper and kind of servant roles. They're very often simulated women are very agreeable and compliant. They'll do whatever you want. So it is an ongoing stereotype, although recently Siri and Alexa have been reprogrammed. So if somebody says something to them that they don't really want to hear or is impolite, instead of deflecting and not even answering, now they'll say, I won't respond to that, or please don't talk to me that way. So that tells us something.
That's interesting. So that's even reflected in Alexa. Is there a question about consent here? Is that part of the picture?
Definitely. Female voices and simulated women, in very often in versions that I'm talking about, never resist or complain.
Let me ask you lastly about this idea of the quote unquote, like, perfect woman and that kind of theme that seems to come throughout your book here. Like, where does that appear? And what is it? What is all of this technology and the way that women are artificial in so many ways? What does it say about that?
Well, there's a long tradition, especially of men who created artificial women one way or another, either as a manufactured kind or virtual kind, that they have this fantasy that the perfect woman is, as they say, very beautiful and agreeable. Polly doesn't have many thoughts of her own. She's very docile. But lately, in films, you can see, and in short stories, that there's a kind of new breed of robots. They want their freedom and independence. They're rebellious. So stereotypes about women are changing, and I think they're mirrored in these simulated women. And they're also working on what are called socially assistive robots. They're robots that will help people who are elderly, which will become increasingly needed, or people who have disabilities. And so that's something that's very good. I think one worry people have is that these simulations might someday displace us. Some people might think they're superior to real human beings, and they'd rather talk to a simulated being, and it might hurt social relationships in one way or another.
All right, we'll leave it there. Julie Wask, author of Artificial Women, Sex Dolls, Robot Caregivers, and More Facsimile Females, joining us to talk more about the book. Julie, thank you for coming on. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you for having me.
A species of squirrel unique to a region of Arizona collects its food could provide some clues about the best ways to protect it going forward. And new research sheds some light on how these squirrels hoard their food. They don't call it squirreling away for nothing. The Mount Graham red squirrel has experienced disturbances over the past several years, including from fires and insect outbreaks. Over the last three decades, their populations have declined significantly. Our next guest says as of December 2023, there were 144 of them. Sean Mahoney is a research scientist in the School of Natural Resources and the Environment at the University of Arizona and is also affiliated with the Mount Graham Biology Programs. He spoke with my co-host Mark Brody, who asked what he was trying to figure out with this research.
Yeah, so finding food is probably the most important thing that an animal needs to do. And finding food can be quite a challenge for an animal. And it can be especially challenging during periods of scarcity, like during the winter when food is just highly limited. And so some animals have just said, okay, I'm not going to deal so much with trying to find food in the winter. And they just decide to hibernate. But there are a lot of animals that don't hibernate. And so they need to still find food during periods of scarcity, like during the winter. And there are three main ways that animals will do this. They'll hoard food. And one strategy of hoarding food is referred to as larder hoarding. And this is when an animal takes a whole lot of food and stores it at a central location. And then they can return to that central location in the winter and access food. And then animals will also scatter hoard food. And this is when animals take smaller amounts of food and hide them across larger areas. And then animals also will do what we've referred to as mixed hoarding. And this is when they'll larder hoard food, but also scatter hoard food. And an example of this are red squirrels in eastern Arizona and on Mount Graham. And so hoarding food is really important for how animals survive through the winter, when food is really limited on the landscape. And so it can be a really important behavior to understand, especially in a conservation context, because it allows us to understand how animals can survive during these periods of scarcity, like during the winter.
And it seems as though you found that, at least for some of them, like there's some amount of flexibility with this, like it's not a system that is set in stone.
Yeah, so what we did in our study was we were primarily interested in understanding this behavior in red squirrels because they exhibit this mixed strategy, and it can offer insights into their conservation planning. We also wanted to understand this behavior in a broader context for mammals more broadly. And when we looked at the evolution of the behavior more broadly within mammals, we found three main patterns emerge from that from that analysis. And what we found was that the hoarding behavior was related to something about the climate. So if a species was living in colder climates, they were more like with more precipitation, they were more likely to larder hoard their food rather than scatter hoard their food. So it seems to be related to precipitation and temperature. And then a third factor that emerged from that analysis was population density. And mammals that were living at higher population densities, so if there were just more individuals of the same species in the area, they were more likely to larder hoard their food. And so given that we found that at this broad analysis of other mammals, we wanted to explicitly test that within Mount Graham red squirrels. And to do that, we used a quarter century data set of Mount Graham red squirrel data. So we had their population density and the number of cones that they stored in their middens for about 25 years. And what we found was that in years when the population density was really high, Mount Graham red squirrels would store more cones in their midden. And this supports the hypothesis that they're experiencing more competition at these higher population densities. And that means the squirrels need to invest more. They need to put more food in their midden and then rigorously defend it from competitors that might try to steal the food from them so that they can survive the winter. But then interestingly, we did not find that temperature and precipitation was related to the number of cones that they would store in the midden.
So what does all of this tell you about the efforts to conserve and preserve this species of squirrel?
So this finding, it's an interesting finding in that at these higher population densities, squirrels tend to put more cones into their midden. And at these lower population densities, which they're living at now, they're living at lower population densities, they're not putting as much food into their midden. And this sort of suggests that they might be shifting to another behavior because they still need to access food during these periods of scarcity, like in the winter. And anecdotally, what we have noticed is that the red squirrels, they still maintain that main midden, but they also have started to develop these kind of smaller middens, which we refer to as satellite middens, around that main larder. And although this isn't full-on scatter hoarding necessarily, it does sort of suggest that it's kind of this modified scatter hoarding behavior. And what this means is that right now, the critical habitat designation for this endangered subspecies is written to protect habitat under the assumption that squirrels are building this central midden. But if they start to shift towards scatter hoarding, then we may need to tweak the critical habitat designations to more better accommodate the habitat needs of the red squirrel.
How big of a shift would that be?
That would be quite a legal challenge that would involve changing the critical habitat designation that's written by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So that would be quite a challenge to do. And I'm not suggesting that that needs to happen now. Mainly what I'm suggesting is that it's important to continue the monitoring of the foraging behavior of the red squirrel, just to keep track of how their food storage behavior might be shifting in response to these population density changes that we're seeing.
All right. That is Sean Mahoney, a research scientist at the University of Arizona School of Natural Resources and the Environment. Sean, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. The architect Eddie Jones moved to Phoenix 52 years ago and immediately fell in love with the desert. He began designing HUD housing at the Lesher and Mahoney firm, but quickly made a name for himself as an innovative designer of what we now call sustainable architecture. A new book about Jones's work has recently been published, documenting his world-renowned Jones Studio, one of the Valley's most notable architecture firms. KJZZ contributor Robert Pala visited Jones there to talk about the building and what it's like to see his work and career summarized between the covers of a book.
The first thing you notice at Eddie Jones' architecture studio is the cluster of Cosanti bells in his conference room.
You know, see how it's cracked? So that one doesn't have much of a sound.
Jones' studio looks less like a traditional office building and more like an artist's enclave, where a lot of people happen to be seated at desks and drawing tables in the center of a wide-open room. There are no framed renderings of Jones's notable work like the concrete, steel, and glass Mariposa land port of entry structure in Nogales, or his renovation of Harold Wagner's sanctuary at Valley Presbyterian Church. Instead, the walls are covered with art made by other famous architects and gifted to Jones. The skylights are positioned just so. The ceiling fans are sculptural. The ceiling of that conference room is covered in tiny metal leaves. I asked Jones whether all these details were meant to inspire his employees.
You know, architecture is more than a building. It's more than shelter. Architecture is emotional. You know, it's one thing to keep the rain off of your head and to keep the air conditioning inside. Buildings do that all the time. That's just like the least they can do. But to be in a space that, to use your word, inspires you, that's wonderful. I might use the word uplifting, joyful, interesting. You know, every day this changes. Look at the beautiful light patterns on that wall. That's coming from a linear skylight up there, and it's reflecting off of the brass leaves, what we call those brass leaves.
A new book titled Strive, Jones Studios Adventures in Architecture, explores the architect's four decades of work here. It documents how Jones and his brother Neil, along with partners Brian Farling and Jacob Benyi, have emphasized nature and the value of water in commercial and residential buildings all over the world. Jones arrived in Phoenix 52 years ago with a degree from Oklahoma State University and a love of the desert.
I had wanderlust throughout my childhood, but I literally was stuck in Oklahoma. All my heroes were somewhere else. Frank Lloyd Wright had been in Arizona. Paolo Soleri was building Arco Santi in Arizona. And then I got a hold of an Arizona Highways magazine, and I saw the photographs of the sunsets and the saguaros and these weird plants that, you know, that don't grow anywhere else. I thought, that's where I need to go. You know, not California, not New Mexico or New York. I need to go to Arizona. And so my son was 2 years old at the time, and we had this Volkswagen Beetle, and my then wife Mary and I packed it up and drove here in August.
Inspired by Frank Lloyd Wright, Jones wanted to create desert dwellings that addressed the realities of our harsh climate. He wondered if he couldn't do that while also forwarding his own ideas about environmentally conscious building designs, designs that predate the green movement that now is a standard of his industry. It turned out that he could. I noticed as we toured the grounds of Jones' studio that many of these ideas are evident there on the property.
All of the rain that hits our roof drains towards this edge of the silver fascia that you see up there. Behind that metal panel is a concealed gutter. The gutter takes the water to the canopy down there, and it takes the water to the canopy here. And as we turn the corner, you'll see how the shape of the steel canopy channels the water to a cistern, which pipes it to the underground storage, which then in turn irrigates our landscape. Look at the parking lot. Do you see stripes? No. Do you see ADA signage? No. Do you see asphalt? No. If you look over the fence, you will see all of that, and that's somebody else's problem. But I told the city of Tempe, you know, do we really need more heat-absorbing black asphalt? Do we really need more hard surfaces that none of the rainwater can penetrate, and then it goes to the street and goes to the sewer?
Jones purchased this lot for next to nothing, in part because it's centered beneath an especially noisy flight path to and from Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport.
I've always said, you know, we're in the last ghetto in Tempe. And since we built our building, there has been a lot of investment. I'm not going to take credit for it, but I like it that people are starting to notice that this leftover neighborhood in Tempe has potential. But one way I could afford this site was it's in the flight path of Sky Harbor. But you know, it's sometimes people build buildings by railroad tracks and or freeways, and it's just part of the experience. And we've kind of, you know, have this great relationship with the sound of 747s coming in every 30 seconds.
This new book about Jones feels like farewell stuff, but he swears he's not going anywhere. Instead, he says, he's protecting his legacy by turning over the company to his partners. Next year at this time, Farling and Benyi will become the new owners of Jones Studio. But Jones will still be here at his drawing table, thinking up new ways to use water and shade while noisy airplanes zip past overhead.
But Eddie Jones will become an employee of Jones Studio, and I will keep my same desk and Brian and Jacob will be completely in charge. In a way, the building sells the commitment of Jones Studio. I don't just consider this my house. I think everybody considers it, you know, their other home. And that's a result of thoughtful design, which can be called architecture.
That was Phoenix architect Eddie Jones talking with KJZZ contributor Robert Pala. That'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more on primary day. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ, the show. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org, and you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.